Welcome to the bonus Q&A for episode 51.
Hi.
Next week is the 1 year anniversary of this whole enchilada.
Oh, the whole enchilada.
The whole thing.
It's true. It came up pretty fast. I can't really believe that we're already at a year, but feels like we did a lot, so that's kind of good.
Yeah, we got kind of a fun segment planned for next week's podcast, looking back at a couple things, so yes. Should be fun.
Thank you, superstars, for your great ideas.
I want to start off the bonus Q&A with a few questions on some hot breaking news topics that unfortunately happened. This always happens. It's like hours after we finish recording the podcast. It's like, pff, news dump.
That's true. Yeah, that's definitely true.
So we will talk about these more next week, but why not talk about them now too? So the first question on this is from Brooke Obscura. What do you think about the E3-related rumor that Nintendo has nothing substantial to show after Tears of the Kingdom launches? Could this be a sign that the games currently under development are being held back for future hardware?
Mm.
So this was a big part of that second wave of reporting that IGN had, where they had like an internal memo from the ESA and this report about Nintendo. We did put up a little short video on our thoughts on this, but
yes.
a little fishy, I think.
It's definitely fishy. It definitely feels very much like, I don't know, it feels unlike Nintendo. So I don't think that there is a lot of truth to it. You know, Nintendo is always they hold their announcements very close to the chest. They like to announce things on their timeline as well. Like, they don't like to be beholden to anyone else's schedule. They've always, you know, when we were there, they were always saying things like, we will announce the games when they're ready to be announced, not because of some event that's happening or some big industry thing. Obviously, when everybody was focused on E3, that was a moment that Nintendo would work towards to have something to announce. But now I think they see the value of Nintendo Directs and just doing things on their own schedule. So I don't think there's any truth to Nintendo not having anything substantial after Tears of the Kingdom. I think that they're just waiting for the right time to announce it on their own terms. So
exactly. Who know what the games and announcements are in Nintendo leading up to an E3. The ESA absolutely does not know what, you know, we're going to have or what we're going to be doing. I don't know exactly how that could have been, like a miscommunication or maybe something that was said in passing that was like, leave me alone kind of thing to somebody at the ESA. So it's a bit strange, but yeah, neither of us are really buying that. You know, the part about Nintendo not going, though, like that could be true. I think we have some thoughts about what it could be that we'll go into a little bit more detail next week. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, Nintendo has a lot of options. They don't have to do E3. It's interesting that, you know, now all three of the first parties are potentially pulling out, and that puts the show in a very weak place. And, you know, Nintendo was always a very staunch defender of E3 because, you know, they have people on the ESA board who are working very hard on all those initiatives. There's an executive at Nintendo, Don James, who is like one of the co-creators of E3 a long, 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 long time ago. So they have a lot of, you know, connections to E3, but it's not entirely a wild thought to say that they wouldn't do it.
Yeah, I think the last thing is, when we were leaving Nintendo, and we talked about this a little bit before, Nintendo had gotten more and more sort of global minded. E3 was always sort of a Nintendo of America focused show, and as time had gone on, it became more of an international thing with the other Nintendo regions coming and bringing developers or bringing press. But I could see, you know, even like NCL or Nintendo in Japan wanting to do things more on like their timetable versus like aligning or having sort of to answer to the schedule or the requirements of a US-based trade show. So that's an area that we saw kind of happening before our eyes, where the Japan office was sort of taking more charge of global announcements and doing things in a way that was more effective for like a global audience. So this is really like focusing on Nintendo Directs, for example, versus these like trade show things that were happening in each region. So that could be another reason why Nintendo is thinking of not participating and doing something that is very much like their own thing.
Paul Gale has the next question, which is also about E3. With rumors circulating that Nintendo, Xbox, and PlayStation will all skip E3 this June, do you think the show can still succeed? E3 means a lot to so many of us, and this was supposed to be a great return. Hopefully there are enough big players to make it work.
Yeah, it was looking a little hopeful for E3 because they had gotten Reed Pop, which is the events team that does PAX, to work on E3. I think E3 needed a big shakeup and a big change to have it feel relevant and have it feel like it's something that is needed in this day and age with everything going more digital. So it was looking like kind of hopeful because we know that PAX is a great show. It's very, you know, fan and community driven, which is great. And that's something that E3 wasn't for a long time. But now I think it's looking pretty shaky. I think without these big publishers there, you just wonder what kind of content is going to be available to carry a show like this and have it feel like the same, cachet, I guess, as it was before. I think that puts a big question mark, on E3 as whether or not, you know, if these publishers don't want to participate because they feel isn't relevant to them, what does it mean for, you know, the gaming community? Is it relevant for us still? I think the answer might be no, you know?
Yeah, you really can't afford to lose much more if all three of those first parties are not there. So, you know, if I was the ESA, I'd be really trying to confirm everybody else. At the same time, you know, we know Jeff Keighley's doing a Summer Game Fest event basically in the same time frame that will also have a physical component to it. So there's kind of perhaps like a battle happening of commit to one and not the other, because you probably can't do both. And we don't know, I don't think we know anybody who's confirmed for Jeff's show, but I'm sure he'll be able to get some people. So it's a little bit dicey. You know, they have the LA Convention Center, which is huge. You know, they might need to consolidate down to a single hall, depending on what they have, just so it's not, you know, completely empty. But it's in a tricky place. And, you know, honestly, since E3 made the decision to let consumers in and kind of shake up that established format that they've done for so long, it's been really shaky. You know, the consumer implementation was not great. There were all those leaked documents about other changes they were going to make, which just seemed weird. And I know when I worked, you know, on E3 things and heard about what the ESA was doing and thinking, I was like, I'm not sure these people are completely on top of this.
Yeah, they seem so definitely out of touch. Right. From the interactions that we had when we were at Nintendo working on E3, we've sat in on many of those like sort of industry-wide calls with the ESA, and it just always felt like they were out of touch and didn't really understand what to do to make the show relevant again. I think that this is now very much manifesting in a way that you can physically see that happening, you know. So
yeah.
While it's unfortunate, I don't know if they can fight back from this, honestly.
All right. That's all for the E3 stuff. Again, we'll talk about that more next week. But our next question is from Jordan Collette. What was the game that introduced you to multiplayer, and what game has been your favorite multiplayer experience?
The game that introduced me to multiplayer was definitely Mario Kart.
Oh, the original Super Mario Kart.
Yes, the original Super Mario Kart, which was very difficult, but definitely was the first time I think I played, played with other people. I mean, we obviously always play Mario games and stuff like that together on my friends, but it's like taking turns, you know, you each kind of take turns with that single player experience. So yeah, this was like a real like wow moment when you finally were able to play at the same time and with like multiple controllers and all that stuff. Really a magical experience.
Yeah, for me, I'm not sure I know exactly what the first was. My mind keeps going to the original Contra on the NES.
Contra.
That's one that comes to mind. You know, there are probably other arcade games that I had played that had multiplayer at the time. But as far as like favorite multiplayer experiences, I think for me, it would be, you know, I had so many in like high school and college, and that kind of aligned with the N64 GameCube generation. Mm-hmm. Of just like, you know, all-nighters with friends playing, you know, Smash Brothers or GoldenEye or Soul Calibur or Mario Kart. Those were definitely good times. Another in college, just kind of with the group of people I had in my freshman dorm was FIFA, which is a kind of a game that I stopped playing once I got out of, you know, freshman year college. But like FIFA was like a daily game that was played regularly in my dorm and everybody else's dorm.
Yeah, I think for me, my favorite, I think I like cooperative multiplayer more than competitive multiplayer. So, I mean, you guys all know by now that I was a huge World of Warcraft player and I really like the raids and like doing dungeons and stuff like that together with your like with your guild. So I loved that in college. I do also really like sort of like the competitive stuff too. I wasn't like a huge Smash player because I'm so bad at it, but that was definitely like always on with my group of college friends. And I think the last one is what was that game? Was it Doom that had like the?
You've talked about Quake, I think.
Quake.
College, Quake in college, you've talked about that.
Yes, Quake. That's it. Not Doom. Quake. I kept getting stuck in the sewer system. That was not great, but it was really fun.
Some more recent ones, you know, like Dragon Quest IX was a really great one that you and I played a ton of.
Oh, I missed that one.
Diablo III. We yes. played pretty much that whole game beginning to end together. That was very fun.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of all the gaming memories, like the best multiplayer moments will always be near the top.
Yeah, yeah. We did a lot of Halo Infinite too, like the co-op stuff or the multiplayer stuff.
Well, first of all, you want Halo Infinite to release co-op. Then you're saying we played hours and hours of co-op. I didn't play that much Halo Infinite multiplayer. What are you making things up now?
You did with like me.
Three nights. That was it.
Oh, maybe I played without you.
You played with somebody else.
I played with somebody else. That's pretty fun.
Okay. You may have learned that I'm a sucker for these two-parter questions from different people, and we have one right here from Frulio and Zroid. Love that team up. Here we go. So Frulio starts with, over the years, we've seen Nintendo release titles such as Brain Age, Game Builder Garage, and Labo. What was the goal behind creating games with a focus on critical thinking and problem solving? Was it to shift the public perception of games as something with educational value, or were there plans to make even greater strides within the game-based learning market? And then Zroid says, this reminds me of something I've always wondered about, so I'll use the opportunity to jump on. Has Nintendo ever tried to make inroads into learning environments such as public schools with some of their educational software? I've always thought some of those titles would be fantastic tools in that setting. So the first part of the question, you know, I think this is a very like Iwata era-esque mindset of expanding the gaming audience. And that's absolutely, you know, what Brain Age was such a good example of that was. And, you know, I think something like Wii Fit 2, obviously Wii Fit is not like educational, but it's the same idea of like taking something that you wouldn't expect to be with a video game and making it into a game. I think there's also just that classic kind of Nintendo mentality of, you know, being interested in these kind of toy-like ideas. There's not necessarily like a hardcore video game, but it's something that you kind of tinker with and is fun for the sake of the tinkering. And I think that's where Labo comes in. So again, I think it just goes back to Nintendo's mindset being a little bit different from pretty much everybody else when it comes to making a quote game.
Yeah, for sure. I think the other thing is there is a lot of like that kind of unique mindset within the Nintendo development team. Like they always think about making a game in a really interesting way. So I think there is a part of them that also wants to share the way that they think through a game that like really prioritizes or focuses on critical thinking or being imaginative or creative. Like they're so creative that they want to like enable you to be creative too through those kinds of experiences that they're making. So
now to the second part of the question, you know, Nintendo, they were always very clear with us of like, this is not edutainment. This is not meant to be an education tool. You know, this is fun in sort of a different way that's using your brain, but it's not like a textbook and it's not a replacement for a textbook. That said, there were times where there were people within Nintendo on our team who tried to make something like this happen. I think Labo was one, right, where they tried to put it into schools?
They did, into a curriculum. I think they did, actually. They were able to, but not maybe in like the sort of the fully integrated way that you would think. It was sort of a peripheral marketing thing where Labo was in classrooms and it was part of like some kind of, you know, art or learning curriculum.
Yeah, those kinds of things always sound great on paper, but are
they're incredibly
extremely
hard.
Challenging to do.
Yeah.
Ultimately, like you can never really quantify the like quote marketing result from it. There was another one that the same person did earlier. Had the Wii, just the Wii system.
Oh.
Certified by the American Heart Association.
No, it was Wii Fit was certified by the American Heart Association.
Well, we'll go back and check.
It was on the box. It was printed on the box, but
exactly.
That partnership was so difficult to like put in place. Ironically, I think this gave the person like a heart condition because he was so stressed out from doing this.
Yeah, those people were not, they did not have a quote big heart. They were very mean.
It sounded cool
from a prestige, you know, like just like name value of like, oh, look at this. But I think the ultimate conclusion was like, maybe this wasn't worth it.
No.
So funny how that works out.
Exactly.
Speaking of a good Nintendo partner, did you ever work with the Make-A-Wish Foundation while at Nintendo? Can you talk about some of the ways Nintendo helped to grant wishes? So we absolutely did do this. And Nintendo is also very closely partnered with the Starlight Foundation, which is, you know, a very somewhat similar charity in working with sick children, where there's a lot of great stuff happening. But producer Hannah, who worked very closely on Nintendo Minute for many years, is based in Redmond and loved doing these sorts of Make-A-Wish visits.
Yeah, they would come to the office and get to spend a whole day, you know, hanging out at the Nintendo office, meeting people and playing games. And we always saw really, really nice photos of some of those visits. And it's so great to see, you know, Nintendo participating and making effort there. And yeah, we used to do those shopping spree videos and we would donate everything to the Starlight Foundation. Or the Make-A-Wish Foundation. So that was always fun as well. Like around the holiday time, we would try to do something and partner with some of those charities as well.
Yeah, with Make-A-Wish, you know, something that was great was a lot of times the wishes were very, you know, it's like I'd like to see, because, you know, sadly, these people are very, very sick. It's like, you know, I would just like to see this with the time that I have left. And, you know, those requests would go all the way up to Japan and they would be very seriously discussed. And, you know, whether we could do it or not, like people were trying really hard to do it. And in the cases where we couldn't do it, like they would find a really cool alternative. So it was very heartwarming that the company really, really took that seriously at all levels and like understood the really positive impact that it could have on these people. Yeah. All right. Daichi has the next question. What are realistically the chances of Mother 3 being released? give me hope or destroy the little amount I have left. So I think we've talked about Mother 3 a few times in that it was kind of in this, the challenges with Mother 3 were so well documented that I think people were a little bit afraid to like even talk about it. It was like this kind of taboo subject. And I think, you know, clearly Reggie was quite tired of being asked about it.
Because he was asked like all the time.
Right, right. So there was that, you know, famous moment in the E3 digital event where he made a joke about it. And now he loves making jokes about it because he doesn't have to deal with it.
He doesn't have to deal with it.
The particulars of why it hasn't been released were never really like openly discussed. I think, you know, you could kind of come to the conclusion that it boiled down to some, localization or like licensing challenges that are just really, really hard. I would say the chances are small, but not like zero. I would not say it's never going to come out.
Yeah, I think it's not zero. But it is one of those things where there's probably a lot of hurdles to jump through to get it to come out. And you're probably, even if people are vocal about it, it's still a pretty small audience of people that would actually play it. I think people are aware of what this game is because of all the memes and the jokes and the years and years of asking. But from like a business, you know, how many copies are we going to sell perspective is probably not going to be like a huge amount. So I think Nintendo must be weighing those two things against each other. Like, is it worth the effort to jump through these pretty hard hurdles to release a game that may not do super, super well? So,
yeah. And, you know, the issue is not that people at Nintendo don't know that people want this. They absolutely know. And I think there are a lot of people in Nintendo that would like to do it. But again, the hurdles have just continued to be very, very challenging. But, you know, we've seen the company kind of surprised with overcoming other seemingly insurmountable hurdles. So again, I would not say that the chance is 0%. So keep holding on. All right, we're going to wrap up with three zany non-gaming questions. First is from Lil Sebastian. Are we ever going to meet Krista's cat? I usually listen to the podcast with headphones and it throws me off every once in a while. Hashtag let them in.
The cat has been in videos before, but yes, you can.
Tell us a bit about the cat. We want to know.
Do you really? Okay. Well, her name is Momo. She is 20 years old and I'm not joking. She's really old. I've had her since she was a kitten. I rescued her. She's a good cat. She, as you can see, she's very vocal. She will meow in any situation, whether I let her out, let her in, close the door, open the door. She just wants to be heard. She's a good cat. She gets along with my two dogs really well. She's actually the one in charge, I think, of the two dogs. We've shown her in videos before. But if you want to see more of her, I will post more photos of her in the pet channel.
I think you should.
Okay.
Okay. Bruce Stash wants to know, Marvel Snap now has a friendly battles mode. Will you two face off each other?
I asked you this yesterday when I saw Bruce Stash's lovely question. And you were like, what now? I don't want to play this game anymore.
Well,
you're very reluctant.
Whoa. Hold on. So first of all, I didn't know that this had come out. So you just plainly asked, are we going to play Marvel Snap? And I'm like, what do you mean? I didn't know what you meant because you didn't explain yourself.
But you should know.
Well, I didn't. It is true that I have kind of fallen off this game in January. Sometime in January, I fell off a little bit. And now I'm feeling, I don't know, I still follow a couple Marvel Snap content creators, and they're always talking about all this new stuff that's in there. So I do feel like slightly scared of like, is there something that's completely changed the game? You tell me, you've been playing a lot still.
I haven't actually, because I've been playing Pocky Jockey. That's been my mobile game of choice since that came out in January. But I did see like they've rebalanced some of the cards and things like that. Some of the cards are that were part of sort of this rebalancing are ones that I use in my like everyday deck. So I'm like, oh, maybe I should jump back in to see what the new features are. So I don't know. I'm still interested in playing the multiplayer. We've been talking about how we were going to try it out once that sort of that mode was released a while ago, but you seem to be reluctant now to play with
it. All right. Well, in that case, if you haven't been like, you know, playing this all day long since it came out,
then don't want me to beat you.
Well, I don't want there to be some huge discrepancy and like, oh, what's this new mechanic? Yeah, I'm not going to tell you. Take this. You know, I don't know.
Oh, you are going to lose regardless.
I know now you like to cheat.
Now you got all these Johns. You're like, oh, I wasn't playing. I don't know these changes and blah, blah.
Fine. We will find a time and a place to do that and share it with everybody. I will give a shout out to that content creator. His name is Cozy Snap. If you would like to look him up, he does stuff on YouTube. And he also has a podcast, which I subscribe to, but I haven't started listening to yet.
Just a Marvel Snap?
That's all he does is Marvel Snap.
But so he wasn't doing anything before this game came out.
And well, I don't know. Maybe he was on some. I don't know. He was on some other game. I don't know. What? He hit it big on Marvel Snap.
Okay.
So you can check him out if you're into that. Our last question is from Sharif Jackson. What chore did you hate the most when you were growing up? Have your feelings changed as an adult?
We were just talking about this because I was very behind on all my chores because I was so busy with Sonic Week and also all the other stuff that we were working on last week that I finally caught up on my chores over last weekend, which felt good. But the chore that I hate the most is folding laundry. I hate it so much. It is literally the most boring. It's so boring. I always have like a podcast on or like I'll watch something while I do it. But it just sucks. Like, you have to, like, look through those piles and match the socks. And then you got to hang up certain things, but not other. You got to fold some stuff. And you got to go put it all away. And just so you could wear it again. It's like, why can't this just be a pile somewhere that I just pick out of? I don't understand. It's annoying.
Laundry's not great. I think for me, it's probably doing the dishes. Growing up, the question is, what did you hate growing up?
I also hated laundry growing up.
I really did not like doing the dishes growing up. I thought it was gross, honestly. Especially it's like somebody else's dish. I'm like, ooh, it's like got your
someone's like
all over it.
Yeah, like slobber all over their
right,
dish.
Right. Nowadays, I just don't care, and I'm glad to do it.
I don't mind the dishes. Do you wear dishwashing gloves?
No, I don't.
I don't either.
Do you?
I don't either.
Dishpan hands? You don't want those? No. Are those real? Do those exist?
I always see those commercials for like Dawn. It's like, this soap is gentle on your hands. But I don't use that because it's like too many chemicals in that.
Yeah, that feels like maybe like a soap. Super, super like antiquated kind of thing. Like, maybe in the 50s. They were
it's like
using
some Mad Men
burn your skin off.
Yeah, it's like lye or something. Like
exactly.
Like peeling like beans or something in the lye. That's
with laundry. Well, do you do like... I don't know, like stuff that says like, oh, hand wash only or line dry only or blah, yada, yada. Do you deal with all that?
I do, but I don't have a lot of clothes that require that because I'm too lazy to do it. So I usually don't buy stuff that's like hand wash, line dry, lay flat. And then there's some stuff that you just give to the dry cleaners just so you don't have to deal with it. Like sweaters, like wool sweaters. You don't want to shrink them, you know, accidentally.
All right. Well, you got to ruin it. Since we're at the end of this, we can go into this. What is dry cleaning? This sounds like a scam.
I think it's some sort of combination of like steaming and like pressing that cleans your clothes. Because they do get out stains and they do... Like they do, you know, like your clothes come back looking clean. So I'm assuming it's working. But like, what are you supposed to do with a cashmere sweater? You can't wash it at home. You would ruin it. So you have to take it to dry cleaning. Right?
I mean, they could just be you know, taking it in the back and putting it in one of those plastic hangers and giving it right back to you. I don't know. Or
no,
spraying
it
with some Febreze or something.
No, that's not what they're doing.
This
that's
is one
not
of the world's, world's great mysteries. It's like that same thing that you told me about.
I think you could go and look at them.
The, what is that? The spray and the dry shampoo.
Dry shampoo.
It's the same idea.
It works. No, it works.
Didn't, I think dry shampoo just got like recalled or something because it was like actually dangerous for you.
Oh,
how does that work
today? So hopefully,
but how
it's
does
not
it
dangerous.
Work?
It
can't work. It's
it
Febreze for your head.
It absorbs the oils in your hair.
Ugh.
That's how it works.
Oh,
and then
my
like
goodness.
Your hair just because you don't need to actually wash your hair all the time because that makes your hair like dry and fall out. I mean, I don't know. Everyone has their own way of taking care of themselves. Definitely take a shower every day, guys, and wash your laundry. I don't know what else to say.
In case
I don't know
anybody
how we got on this tangent.
Would like to ask, we will not be opening a hygiene channel on the Discord. Thank you very much.
Okay, yeah, this is where I draw the line. But
we have reached.
I will say.
Oh.
Don't wear your shoes in bed as a one note. Shoes in the bed, no.
In bed or on the bed? Like, don't sleep with shoes on?
No, don't even get into your don't even lay on your bed with shoes.
Don't sit on it. Yeah, don't lie
don't
on it.
Don't sit on your
shoes.
Bed with your shoes on, please. I beg
correct.
Of you. I beg good. Of you, everyone. All of you.
All right. You're getting worked up. It's time for us to go. Hope you enjoyed this. We'll see you next time.
Bye. No shoes in bed.